So today is, as mentioned, Stewardship Sunday, a day when we talk about this place, about what we're here to do, about what makes it all happen, and when we talk about money, what it means to us, how it feels to us. As I was thinking about all this, the following story came to my mind. I was leaving the main room of some event years ago, heading toward the door to go home, when I noticed this woman eyeing my name tag. She was. It was a nice one. It was sturdy, see-through plastic, clip-on, no safety pins anywhere. And it had my name on it, Ellen. Nice big bold letters. Maybe it even said Ellen Q. As I kept walking, the eyeing escalated to intervention. The woman accosted me. "Hi, Ellen," she said in a friendly enough voice. "May I have your name tag?" I must have looked puzzled because she said it again. "May I have your name tag?" I must still have looked confused because she went on to explain. "We only have so many," she said. "We collect them at the end of events to reuse. They're expensive." Now, as noted, this was years ago, years and years before being green was a thing, before everyone was recycling and reusing. And what I noticed was, as soon as she asked me for it, I wanted it. I did. I hadn't particularly wanted it before. After all, what am I going to do with a name tag, really? Wear it around the house? But her wanting it made me want it. And there was something about that feeling that there wasn't enough to go around. Maybe I should be collecting them myself for some event I might run one day. You never know. What if? I did give it to her, of course. But I remembered this story recently because I noticed while decluttering a few weeks ago that I have a stack of plastic name tags in my closet that I collected from other events that didn't ask for them back. I had accumulated a nice pile. It's almost like that interaction flipped a switch in my brain. There are not enough name tags. Must keep them all, just in case. I did finally recycle them, but it was a fascinating look into that half-aware, one-year-old part of me that can get surprisingly possessive, that feels like there's not enough, must hold on, mine. Actually, maybe that's not a fair assessment of one-year-olds, because I've seen them in action, and they are some of the most generous people I know. I still remember when my nieces and nephew were young. They would give me stuff unprompted. Granted, it was all about as valuable as one of the aforementioned name tags, but they gave from the heart. They gave with obvious joy. They would hand me that special rock or twig or treasured Lego piece standing there on wobbly legs, looking up into my eyes, waiting for my pleased response, which they always got. Not because of the thing, but because of the giving and the absolutely simple pleasure of the exchange. None of us are 1 year old, however, and giving rarely feels so simple anymore, or so free. There's a lot that gets in the way. Tangled and competing priorities. I know I struggle with this. I want to give money for justice, for humanitarian aid for the migrant caravan, for families in Pittsburgh. I want to give money to my alma mater and to candidates I support in the upcoming election. I want to be generous everywhere with everyone, but that same darn voice is talking to me all the time, saying, well, what about this, and what about that other thing, and what if I need it? And sometimes, of course, I do. I find it very difficult sometimes to separate out the imagined needs from the real ones. Hard to separate the name tag needs from the true necessities. It can get me so tangled up, I don't even know where to begin, really. Money is confusing. We know this. There's a reason they say it's one of the top causes of conflict in marriage. It triggers us. We've been taught not to talk about it. When people bring it up, we don't like it. And as I said to someone else recently about a different topic, talking about money and money decisions, about competing priorities, is not even like comparing apples with oranges. It's more like talking about apples and skyscrapers. I mean, how do you compare spending money on clothes for kids or dinner out once in a while, with spending money on a trip to see family you do not see enough, with supporting causes you care deeply about that might make things better for everyone? How can you possibly weigh saving for college with saving for retirement, with buying something you want just because, to building up a community that feeds your soul and guides your children? It's impossible. There's no right answer. There's no one answer, and thinking about it makes me dizzy, personally. Not a good place to be when you're trying to write a sermon on the topic. Yet, here we are, in this church, talking about a congregation that you love, that I love, that we want to see flourish. A church that is and can be a beacon, literally a beacon in a dark time. I got an email from Al Jeffries a couple of weeks ago asking that we make sure to leave the lights on overnight this coming Friday, where we will be commemorating Kristallnacht, which Jerry mentioned in our Joys and Sorrows, the night of breaking glass, the horrific destruction that began the devastation of the Holocaust 80 years ago on November 9th, 1938. An act committed in the wake of hateful rhetoric from the state. So we are going to leave the lights on that night as a symbol that we will not stand by idly in the face of hate. We will not stand idly by when our neighbors, our friends, people we love are targeted. We've done this nearly every year I've been here, and I understand for years long before that. We can be a beacon in a dark time. We must be a beacon, a shelter in a storm. Last month, we talked about finding sanctuary for ourselves here and being sanctuary for others, living our values here and bringing them to the world. And today, in this month of memory, I want to remember who Westminster has been, who we are now, who the world is calling for us to be. In a testimonial last year, Meg Carroll spoke not only about appreciation for our race discussions, which help us be more awake and aware here and in the world. She spoke not only about gratitude for visits from Westminster friends to dialysis for her husband, David. But she also spoke about the fact that this place is an island of safety for her gender transitioning grandchild. A grandchild who said, when Mom asked about helping smooth the way at church, "No, Mom, the people at church, they get it." Westminster, living our values. And we heard last year from Jerry Tisser, Jerry, who is Jewish, and Mary Jean, who is not Jewish. Years ago, their neighbor pointed them, now an interfaith couple, to this church when Jerry's oldest son was a toddler. And taking that piece of advice to come here, Jerry said, began 30 years of meeting people who shared their values and lived those values by supporting the entire family through life's changes. And we've had some big ones, Jerry said. The mother of that toddler died 11 years ago, and my youngest son had a spinal cord injury in 2014. I would not have expected any of this, he said, knowing the way I came in, but I can tell you with great sincerity that this community has been my rock. Thank you, Jerry, for letting me share that again. And it's Westminster, living our values. And recently, Dylan Kennedy came to me because he was thinking about ministry as a vocation. Dylan is a young adult now. He was raised in this church by many of you, raised with these values. And when I asked him about the impact Westminster had on him, he said, "This place has been instrumental in how he goes out in the world. He found such a sense of acceptance and belonging, and he wants to bring that to other people. He tries to bring that energy to everything he does," he said. Westminster, living our values. And then, of course, the words that Brian spoke this morning, being inspired by our youth and opportunities to do service for them and with them. Living our values here and bringing them to others, to this world, this difficult world that needs people living their values. There was a story this week, maybe you saw it, about the hospital where the Pittsburgh shooter was taken. The man was still spewing hate against Jewish people in the emergency room. He was yelling. He did not know that three of the doctors and nurses who cared for him, who were keeping him alive, were Jewish. He did not know that the president of the hospital, Jeffrey Cohen, was Jewish when Cohen came to check on him, asked about his pain, made sure he was okay. Cohen lived close enough to the synagogue, the article said, to be able to hear the gunshots. And he knew 9 of the people killed. "I thought it was important to at least meet him and talk to him," Cohen told ABC. "You can't on one hand say we should talk to each other and then I don't talk to him, so you lead by example." And that's what he did. There was another story this week where Wasi Mohammed, the leader of the Pittsburgh Islamic Center, spoke about the money raised by Muslims for the families of those killed or hurt. $70,000 in one day. "And we're not going to stop," he said. "We're going to keep asking what you need. More money, people to stand guard outside your next service. Someone to come to the grocery store with you if you don't feel safe. We're here for you. We are here for this community," he said, "just like you were here for us. After 9/11, after the elections when hate crimes spiked against Muslims, we are repaying the favor." People living their values in hard times. We are all called to live our values, and it's not easy to do. So, what is it worth to us? What is it worth to have a place of rest, of acceptance and belonging here? A place from which we can continue to offer our hearts to the work of the world. A place where we can refuel and then bring more of our best selves to a time that needs us. A place where we can guide the young people we love to do the same. How can that be calculated? Maybe it can only be decided. Maybe it can only be risked. These times scare me. They make me want to hunker down, turn off the news, hide under the covers, and that voice in my head that tells me to lay low and stay safe is getting louder. But another voice is saying, do something. And that voice is getting louder still. It's not just about money. Brian spoke eloquently about the service, the incredible service he's offering to Westminster. So many of you are taking action in the world and offering service here, even though for many of us, time, just like money, can feel in far too short supply. We don't have enough. We need to hold on to it, just in case. As I've gone through this week writing this sermon piece by piece, witnessing the events in the world, I've been finding myself connecting more and more with that inner one-year-old I referred to earlier, the one that lives from the heart, the one that wants to do something, the one that finds joy in giving, the one that knows that security doesn't really come from money or extra careful time management. Although I had previously given to some of those causes I mentioned at the start of this sermon, by the time I was done, I'd given to all of them. And I raised my pledge so that this year I'll be giving $4,700 instead of $4,500. And it feels good. I don't feel more afraid. I feel more committed to the values that I care about. What might it mean for you to remember? To imagine a fresh start, a deeper start, a new level of commitment to this place you have come or are coming to love. This congregation flourishes because of you, because of your love and care. It takes the work of dozens and dozens of volunteers, and it does take money. And when we give to this place, when we share in whatever ways you are called to share, when we tap into our heart, we just might find some of the fear we may be feeling fading into the background. We just might feel more committed, more full, more connected. And we will know we are part of this great project, part of the healing, of the caring for this hurting but precious and beautiful world. May it be so. Amen.